Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Tonight, our 40-minute speaker is Alice from Mission Viejo.
Hi, I'm Alice, alcoholic.
Hi, Alice.
And could you join me in a serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Thank you. I'm really grateful to be here tonight. I want to thank Betty for asking me and for being so kind to remind me, because I forget things. And it's such a nice group. San Clemente is a pretty special place for me. I didn't live here, but my granddaughter came down and lived with me for 4 months in Mission Viejo, and she found out that she could get away with stuff here in San Clemente. And I got to visit their jail a couple times, and I got to pick her up there. And, you know, so no matter how long you've been sober, you're still going to come out, end up in the police station somewhere for some reason. But, you know, two of my friends came down with me tonight from Mission Viejo, Mike and Mary and Andrea. And that's a real honor to have somebody come with you and to, you know, to support you and know that you're not alone. You never have to be alone. Once you come to AA, you don't have to be alone. I can only start my story with what happened to me, and my story is my story. I was born in a family of 11 children. I'm number 6. I had 5 brothers, myself, my 2 sisters, 2 brothers, and another sister. Anybody else from big families here? And it's different. People from big families understand. Any redheads here? Redheads understand about being a redhead. It's just different. I grew up in this family. It's Irish Catholics. Any Irish Catholics? All the big families and all the redheads, right? But I feel at home now. Now I know I belong. But the neat thing about it is that in that family, I wasn't raised by one of those families that was telling you have to do this, you have to do this, you have to do that, you can't do this. It was just don't lie. Be kind to your brothers and sisters. Help your mother. And go to Mass on Sunday if you don't have to. My brothers really figured it out. They didn't have to go to Mass on Sunday. All they had to do was find out what the vestments were and what the gospel was going to be for that week. So they go to church, check out the priest, what he had on, read the gospel, and go home. So my dad wasn't stupid. He knew that they learned their Bible somehow. But he never really enforced it. He never really checked on them or anything. But so we didn't have the real mean Catholic family, and we did rosaries at night. And my brothers were always getting in trouble, and I was always a good kid. My brothers got everything. I wanted to be a boy because they got BB guns when they were 5 years old, and they got to box and learn all this stuff. And my dad didn't even know I was learning to box while they were learning to box. I just did it in the background. You know, I did shadow boxing and whatever. And so I always wanted to be one of the boys so I could get my BB gun. But when my brother that's a year and a half older than I shot into the ground with the BB and it hit my dad in the head, they decided no more BB guns for 5-year-olds. So I never got one. And he used to beat the boys because they'd always do stuff. They'd go leave the house for a week and live down in the valley, and they'd have to go find them, and they get in trouble. And so I was the one that was like, I'm not going to be like them. I'm not stupid. You know what not to do. And I had to make rules. And my family grew up that way, and couldn't wait to get to church. I couldn't wait to be, you know. My brothers were always going to be zapped by God because of what they did wrong. And I had this protective shield. I don't know, tell them my age, the Colgate tooth that had the protective shield on it. That was me. I was protected. I had 5 brothers that were like the toughest guys in Cleveland. And they were known for that. And so I never was afraid of anything. And I knew how to box and everything. Nobody knew that, but I did. And but I was afraid of me. I always was, if I have to have rules, I have to know what to do. Anybody else do rules? I mean, if I just do all this, then I won't get in trouble. And so I was like that. And when I was 8 years old, we moved away from my my home. We lived in a projects there. Anybody else from the projects? But we moved from there, and we bought a house, an old farmhouse, a dilapidated farmhouse. They had to get the rodents out before we could move in. They had to put plumbing in before we moved in. They had to put a furnace in shortly after we moved in. And so it wasn't anything wonderful, but to me it was. And we, you know, your perception, little kid said he was talking about perception, and my perception was we had a house with flowers in the yard. We had a house we could paint any color we wanted, inside and outside. And we had fields of wild strawberries. Everything grew free, you know, really wild out there. We could make apples and apple pies, and I just loved it. And my brother Fran, who was next to me in the family, had the same perception. He loved his childhood. Guess what? He's an Alcoholics Anonymous today, too, so we found our niche. But we both had a different childhood from the rest of them. And my other brother, who was the second oldest and responsible one, he was the best one in the family, I thought, and he was going to become a priest. But got in an argument with the priest one time and decided not to be a priest. And at 17, after the same time that I was going through... my mother had surgery, and the little kids had to go to an orphanage for 6 months because my mother was not physically healthy well enough to take care of the last three kids. And so I used to help her all the time. But all of a sudden, that's gone, and I met this girl, and she was so cool. And we'd have cigarettes and coffee on our way to third, fourth, and fifth grade. And the other rule in the family was you don't show bad example. So thinking I was good, not showing bad example, I was sneaky. I never got caught. Nobody knew I was doing that. I didn't swear in public. I never showed anybody, you know, the kids that I was, what I was doing or not doing. I was trying to be really good. And when I was 11 years old, I stopped hanging out with that girl because people were getting pregnant over her house because there's no supervision. People were getting in trouble, going to jail from that house. And so at 11 years old, when she tried to beat me up, and I just looked at her with that insane redhead look that she had never seen on me before, because I was always sweet. It was hard for me to be good and nice, but I did it because I knew if I don't, I'm going to be in trouble. You know, it's going to be over for me. And so I just looked at her, and I said, "What are you trying to do?" And she says, I'm going to beat you up. I says, "Get away from me before I kill you." And I walked. I just walked. Just the way I looked at her, she just got up and got out of my way. And you know, that's the insanity. I had already laid out my brother one time. He had bothered me, you know, started poking at me and had me up against the refrigerator. And he was poking at me. And I finally bit his finger as hard as I could. And he slapped me in the face. That was his reaction. And immediately I kneed him in the groin and elbowed him in the back to his flat out. And he was 6 foot. And he was 6 foot something. And I was like, oh my God. And all I kept hearing was, "Mom, stop her. She's killing me." I all of a sudden came to, and I'm like, "Oh my God, I hurt my brother." And the sweet Alice starts crying for hours in her bedroom. "Oh my God, I could have killed my brother." And that was the person I was afraid of. I knew there were two people inside this body. I knew there were two people. And I was always afraid of that other Alice. So I tried to be really good. And at 11 years old, I had to quit hanging around with my best friend, and had to get active in choir and Girl Scouts and anything that I could keep busy, you know. And I don't know how many of you are trying to keep busy now that you're sober. You can only keep so busy, you know. But if you're going to meetings and you're working with others and you're actually taking an honest inventory and you're doing those steps, you're going to be okay. And just don't drink. And, you know, people say, "Well, you can't just not drink." I say, "Oh, yeah, you can." Because the insanity that goes with that first drink, it doesn't stop. I didn't drink all the time I was dating. I was very confused growing up because I was trying to be this good person. All my friends were getting married and pregnant and married, and I didn't want to do that either, so I had more rules here. You know, don't kiss longer than 15 seconds. That was when the nuns gave me that one. You know, it was like, don't kiss more than 15 seconds because then you'll arouse the boys and you'll have problems that you might not be able to handle. Now, that was a good plan. But the poor guys, when you're kissing them and you're going, they didn't ask you out again. So it gets very lonely when you're a teenager. But it was a rule that saved my life. Get home by midnight. That was one, you know. So I did that. But I got married. I dated. My brothers were very critical of me. I don't know if any of you had critical family that told you that you had a fat behind, buck teeth, separated teeth. If you had one pimple, you were a pimple face. get ugly red hair, you get ugly brown eyes, you know, and I just thought I was this ugly little girl, you know, and but I always dressed pretty and tried to smile, you know, and be sweet Alice. And didn't know, I thought my brothers were the handsomest guys on the west side of Cleveland, besides being the toughest guys. A couple of them got broken noses being the toughest guy, but they were still handsome. I'm looking back now, you know, my brothers were red hair, brown eyes, and I thought they were the best. So, you know, your perception is nuts when you're trying to be part of the world and you don't feel like part of the world. I met a lot of friends. I have friends that I've known since I was 6 years old, and what happens is that I made rules like I don't go out with guys who drink or want to drink when they're on a date with me. If they want to drink, they go out drinking. If they want to date me, go out with me, you know. And I just had this common sense insanity. It was just, it saved my ass. It saved my life. But I just didn't do that, you know. And one guy was telling me his car. Look at my car. Look at my car. I got a brand new 63. It was in 63 those days. And I said, I'm not going out with your car. Oh. Well, most of the girls that go out with me because of my car. I says, well, can you talk? Can you sing? Can you do anything besides drive your stupid car? And so I wasn't a materialistic girl either. But I dated guys, and I couldn't figure out why all the popular, handsome guys didn't ask me. I thought it was because I was ugly. And just before I married my first alcoholic husband, I asked this one guy, how come you never asked me out when we were kids? Was I that ugly? And he said, oh, no, 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 no. Your brothers told me if I talked to you, they would kill me. And so that was half of the public school boys and all the popular guys, you know. So they were always kind to me, and I had a lot of brothers. And that's a healthy thing, too, is I grew up with a lot of guys that told me their problems. And my dad used to say men and women are the same except for the plumbing. And the feelings my brothers would get, girls would ask them out and cheat on, you know, and they would ask them out, and they'd go meet the girls, and they wouldn't show up. And they'd, ha-ha, we pulled it over these boys, you know, my brothers, and they thought they were so cool. But my brothers were heartbroken, and I realized that men and women are the same except for the plumbing. And I had my sex education growing up was, my mother told me that you don't do anything before you get married, and after you get married, you can do everything. So that was it. That's the Catholic mother. So I married my first husband. He was, I was dating him, and he wasn't the best looking guy, and but he was fun, and he had creativity, and he was Irish Catholic and loved children, and so did I. So that was all I wanted, you know. And so we got married my mother-in-law sat me down, my mother-in-law-to-be sat me down. You don't want to marry him. It's just going to be trouble. You're going to have problems. You should know that by now, you know. And I figured, you know, but I love him. You know, I was 18, turning 19. I should know everything. Graduated from high school. And so we got married against everyone's wishes, and I wasn't pregnant. People said that I was, you know, oh, yeah, they got married pretty fast, didn't they? But we dated 2 years, come on. And he was a gentleman the whole 2 years because I had all these rules. We ended up having, he was AWOL for when we got married. Yep, he was AWOL because he couldn't get a leave. He was afraid he was going to get a leave to come for the marriage, the wedding. And so he got a leave anyways. His own. He told me later, he says, I'm AWOL, we got to get right back. I said, I wanted to have a trip and visit. Yeah, I've never been out of Ohio, and here I'm going to Oklahoma. And he wanted me to go without my car. I didn't do that. I took my car. But I was responsible and very, very independent. And we ended up with a 13-year marriage. During that time, he demolished a couple cars. He had problems. He wanted to get me drunk. That's what it was. One beer, man, you know, because I was crazy without it. I told him, come over to the house. We're going to go swimming. And he says, my neighbor's house. And he says, your neighbors don't have swimming pools, because I didn't live in the real affluent. I lived by the airport in Cleveland. And I says, well, yes, they do. I went over to where I babysat, and the little girl had like a, you know, 18 inches tall and 15 inches round, 15 feet round swimming pool, and I dove into there. And he says, you're nuts. One beer, man, you know. And I was afraid of me. My brother ended up at during that time, my best brother joined the service at 17, quit school, and May of senior year, he quit school and joined the Marines. And within a year and a half, he was out on a undesirable discharge because of his drinking and everything he did under the influence. He was eventually, he was able to get that fixed. And my ex-husband got general discharge under medical conditions because of his alcoholism. So it does, you know, the rules change as you go. But this man got married, and I got pregnant after. But during this time, we went to Oklahoma, and that was my first real drink. He decided one beer, man, you know, and he decided to get me drunk. And I said, okay, we're married now. I don't care. You know, I'm with the right person. I'm not going to mess up. And so I had a big old bottle of Irish whiskey and a big old bottle of ginger ale, and I thought a highball was half ginger ale and half whiskey, and so I poured it, and I started drinking. And I drank that first one down, and I put another one up, and all of a sudden, the sweet Alice that never swore in front of this man, this gentle lady, was cussing worse than my brothers ever cussed in my life, saying things that I never said before. I remember that one thing I remember about the night was I was standing behind this little trailer we were renting in Oklahoma, and I'm banging on the door cussing like a sailor and swearing at him. And the next morning, my iron skillet had the handle broken off of it, and I'm looking at it, and I'm going, what happened to the skillet? He says, you hit me in the head with it. And see, I didn't believe him because but this girlfriend that I had when I was growing up, my mother used to say, if somebody lies to you, they're not really your friend. And so I go, by all these, any little rule you tell me, I'll remember, you know. And so I says, Mom, but she lies to me, but I know she's lying, and she needs a friend. She doesn't have any friends, and I'm her friend. She says, well, if someone lies to you and you know they're lying, they're not lying to you, they're just lying. Kind of sounds like a newcomer, you know. And they're telling you a story, and you're listening to it, and it's their perception, and it's really truth to them. And you listen to it, and you let them. And about 2 weeks later, they'll come back to you and say something like, "Remember when I told you about this? You know, that's not really how it happened." Well, that's how this my husband would tell things. So I, as soon as he told me you hit me in the head with it, I felt his head. It didn't have any bumps on it, so I knew it was. I didn't hit him in the head with the frying pan. But you know, the funny thing is that about 3 years ago, there was a woman who was put in prison for killing her husband with a frying pan. So had that been true, you would have a different speaker tonight. And I would not be here. I could still be locked up. But so that was the first time I drank. It scared the heck out of me. I thought, oh my God, I don't remember. I could have killed him, anything. And then I go back to when I laid my brother out. Oh my God, when I get out of control, I'm out of control, you know. So we went on 13 years of this, in and out. He got out of, I didn't drink again until he came home on leave. He went back to, he went to Germany, and I wasn't going to Germany. I wasn't having my kid in a foreign country. One of my rules. And so he went to Germany, kept writing me letters. Honey, you know, if you come to Germany, I'll be able to get an extra allotment for beer. Oh, I'm going to jump over there. I'm going to run to Germany for you, dear. So I can be pregnant. You can be drinking double your amount. No. So I didn't go. And so when he came home in April, I was like a little kid. I was 19 years old, pregnant with my first child, so excited, and had a romantic evening set up. And they didn't have that fetal alcohol syndrome knowledge of that in the early 60s like that. So, but I had this little Italian wine bottles, a little Italian restaurant. We had a little hotel on the valley, which looking over the valley. And I was so excited. And after all those little bottles of wine, you know, the kind with the straw on the bottom of them, those little bottles. I don't know how many we drank, but I know that I don't remember anything. And he says, I says, how was last night? And he says, oh, it was great. I said, oh, good, I'm glad. I was like, oh my God, I don't remember anything. And that scared me again. So I didn't drink again. I just thought, I can't drink. This is not good. He might remember, but he didn't say that he didn't remember, but I don't remember. That scared me. Not, you know. And so I didn't drink again until Memorial Day. And that was like a month and a half later. And we, you know, you forget real quick. So we're up in the islands, and they're telling me we're going to go to the winery. And my perception is, oh, Girl Scout time. We're going to the winery to see, you know, wine made, you know, like Lucy smashing grapes with your feet and all that kind of stuff. I was all into that. And so I thought, this is cool. And I'm eight months pregnant, wobbling along. My girlfriend's 8 months pregnant, wobbling along. And the two cousins, my husband and his cousin. We go down there and we start buying wine. I'm going to buy it for my brothers. I got a big family, so I got like five bottles of wine or whatever. And they say, well, you're not 21. You can't take it to the mainland. And so I don't know about you, but there's always a rule in an alcoholic home, you don't waste booze. It's just not automatic. You either give it to your neighbor or you drink it. And so we drank the wine. We laid on this hill, this grassy hill in the middle of Lake Erie, drinking. And all I remember was laughing all the way back, and my friend Madeline was crying all the way back. And we finally get back, and they go, "Oh, let's go canoeing." And I'm thinking again, this little 19-year-old stupid brain of mine, oh, how romantic. Two wobbly, big, giant, pregnant women and going on a canoe ride in the evening. Problem was, we get in the canoe and my husband says to his cousin, "Hey, Jimmy, let's race them." I was like, "What the hell?" And whoop, over went the canoe, and there I was, screaming and yelling and hollering like a sailor again, you know. Had no control. Alcohol changed me to another person. I mean, when I was 16 years old, I didn't know if I wanted to be a nun or a go-go dancer. And there's so much the same, you know. And then when the Flying Nun came out, I really was confused. But those are the kind of things that happen in my perception, in my insanity. What happened to... I didn't drink again. It scared me. And so my husband went back to the service. He's supposed to go back to the service, but the baby wasn't due till July. And from April to July is more than 45 days, which was his leave. So he stayed AWOL and around the area, never knowing where he was. So what happened was I just didn't tell anybody he was there, but I kept telling my doctor. I told my doctor I don't know what to do, and I kept having false labor. So he decided to induce the baby, and so this guy went back. I sent him on a train. I sent him on a plane. I sent him on a bus. He kept showing up, and finally he got back in the service and the stockade, and I was by myself, and it was good. And then his parents were trying to get him out on an alcoholic discharge. And they knew senators, they knew a lot of people high up there. And so they were going to get him out on an honorable discharge. And I said, "Why? I'm finally getting an annulment check that I don't have to pay off the car he demolished. No, don't get him out yet. Give me a couple months of money." And they got out. And by the grace of God, you know, he went into an alcoholic rage at my house. And I didn't have Al-Anon at that time. And I didn't have AA. I didn't have anything. And he got home that night after being gone for over a whole day drinking. And he came in the door, and I said, "Here, I made your dinner." I kept it warm. And he said, "Leave me alone." And I said, "What do you mean, leave you alone? I've been alone for a whole year. What the hell, you know? You can at least sit down and eat meal." And he just started, and he went into this rage. I saw this look in his eye, and I walked out of the house with my baby next door and heard all this noise next door, and I just, oh, my God. So I came back, and there was blood everywhere. There was blood everywhere. My refrigerator was dumped. And like the good wife, I called the police. "Oh, I think my husband's bleeding to death." Not thinking about it could have hurt me or hurt himself. You know, it's just, "I think my husband's bleeding to death." He said, "We've had 4 calls already. We're already on the way, you know." And we found him in the field bleeding, and went to the hospital, and he had a choice. Either go with the police. He says, "You want to go home with your wife? You want to stay here with us?" He says, "Sure as hell don't want to go with you." So he ended up in jail. And they put him in a detox, and the key keeper at jail happened to be his father's sponsor in AA. And he says, "You want to go to jail or you want to go to get some help?" And he went to a detox. And by the grace of God, he got sober. And I was going to live happily ever after. And while he was gone, though, his father, in November, just before he got out of the service, was my last drink, November 8th of 1966. And what happened was, I was going through this thing. They call it bipolar, but it's really fast. I don't know how they call that. But it was like I'd cry and laugh, cry and laugh. I'd call somebody up, "How are you doing?" "Oh, I'm doing great. Oh, I'm so glad you called," blah, blah, blah. Hang up and cry. And then someone would call me, and I'd be so glad they called that I forget I was so miserable. And I'd start crying again. And I couldn't call my mom on that. I couldn't call anybody else on that because I didn't want to say it had to do with anything that he did or my loneliness or my bad decision to get married so young. I didn't want it, so I called my husband's father, and I said, "I don't know what to do. I think I'm going crazy." He said, "I'll be right over." And he came over, and he said, "Here, I brought this for you. This will calm you down. You can use this big old bottle of wine." And I go, "Okay." And I'm like this, you know, and I take a tumbler, real nice tumbler, fill it up with the wine, and I drink it down like Kool-Aid, just drink it down. And all of a sudden, I said, And my head goes, "He's a man, you're a woman, he's not going to tell anybody, you're not going to tell anybody." Mother's side says, "Get him the hell out of the house. This is a father of 10 children, very active in the church, very nice person, very handsome, 40-something, I'm 19. And I'm going, "What? get him out of the house. So I got him out of the house. And that pitiful and comprehensible demoralization they talk about in chapter 3, it was there. All I knew is all I had to do was act on it, and I would have been in trouble. I would have lost something I had. I didn't have money, I didn't have property or prestige, but I had self-respect. That's all I had. And I was able to hold on to that. And I thought, well, as long as I don't drink, I won't become an alcoholic. And he's already coming out an alcoholic discharge. We don't need two alcoholics in the family, you know. So I thought, okay, so I'll just not drink because I can do that. And my mother never drank, so I don't have to drink. But, you know, he got sober, and then he started drinking. And then he got sober, and he started drinking. And they put me in Al-Anon. They said, you need to go to Al-Anon. He goes to AA. And he told me, if you go to Al-Anon, I'm not going to AA. And so I went upstairs and cried because in our family, you either punch walls or you cry. And I was a girl, so I cried because I would have probably got really violent. But so this lady says, you get in the car. You know how they say in Al-Anon, get in the car. And so I got in the car, and he got in the car, and we both went to AA and Al-Anon together. And I was happy. I was happy. I had rules of how to live in an alcoholic home. My uncle had died at 33. Just shortly after that, my uncle had died when I was pregnant with my daughter. And he was 33 years old. His wife was complaining he was drinking too much and their marriage was going to end. And she says, you have to stop drinking. So for Valentine's Day, he quit drinking. 3 days later, he died in alcoholic convulsions. That's how my family, you know, that's what alcohol does in my family. His father, who was quit drinking for 25 years, the story's in the big book. It sounds like my grandfather. He stopped quitting for 25 years so he could raise his family and be a policeman and be a detective with Elliot Ness and all that stuff. And when his son died so suddenly, he started drinking. 4 years later, he was dead. So alcoholism in my family is, and they lie, you know, they said, oh, well, it was because he had cirrhosis of the liver, and that was because of his poor eating habits. You know, read the big book, you get some facts, you know. So what happened was I waited for my husband to get out of service. He went to AA. I went to Al-Anon. Everything was wonderful. And then I started going to AA meetings, speaker meetings like this. They didn't call in speaker meetings. They just gave a talk. However long it took for the man to tell his story, then they'd have comments. And so you had to be really honest in Cleveland when you tell your story, because there's somebody in there who knows your 12th step and is going to, you know, nail you on it. And so what happened was I was listening to these women share, and they talked all about how they drank, how they got to this point, and where I got to the point where I almost went to bed with my father-in-law. They went on. They did that. They lost their children. They lost their self-respect. They lost their marriage. They lost everything. And so I kept saying, God, that sounds just like me. Except for they went further. And so I started going to AA meetings to try to, you know, because I identified so much with all of that insanity. And I went to AA meetings on the weekends so I wouldn't drink. I went to Al-Anon during the week so I wouldn't kill anybody or run away from home. And it worked. You know, it really worked. And but at 11 years sober, the disease of alcoholism progressed in my head. The disease of alcoholism still kept saying, but you were never that bad. You only drank a few times. You really weren't bad. Nobody knew what you thought. Nobody knew you were going to go to bed with your father-in-law. But I knew. And that was the insanity here that was driving me crazy. And so what happened was, at 11 years sober, I had a choice. I was pregnant with number 6. My husband, when he gets sober and everything was wonderful and he's making good money, we'd have a child. Then when he started drinking again, we'd be, you know, destitute. Then he'd start, you know, then it was just like, the last one was 4 years old, my baby. It was 4 years old, and I said, I'm not having any more children with this man, you know, and I made him up, you know, I knew how to do that. And what happened was, he was sober, things were going great, and he asked me if I wanted to have another child. Then we'd have 3 boys and 3 girls, the perfect family, you know. And I said, okay. And I said, if we do it tonight, we're going to have a baby. And so we did. And he's 32 years old today. But going through, in July of 1977, the insanity in my head kept saying, if he would just stay sober long enough for me to drink, if he would just stay sober long enough for me to drink. My turn, you know, it was like, a rite of passage. It's my turn to screw up. I never got a chance to screw up. What, you know, if he just stay sober long enough, because he was like Saint Jack, and then the idiot or the whatever, the Saint Jack, and that I was married in love with Saint Jack, but this other guy I didn't know who he was, and but I mean, I finally decided I was either going to kill him, but I wasn't going to hurt him. I didn't want to hurt him. I just wanted to kill him. I wanted to put him out of his misery like you do a dog or an animal. You know, I just felt it's insanity here, but that's how I said in my head was, I don't want to kill him. I just want to put him out of his misery. And the second thought was, join him, because then you won't be lonely, because loneliness was was killing me. And so then you won't be lonely. You'll be with him, and if you do, you know, you'll be with your husband, so you can do anything you want. You don't have to be lonely. And then I thought, or get active in AA and stay sober. And that was the one that's run out. And the reason why it went out was because in 77, they didn't have the Reflections book that we have today, but they had the 24-hour book, and I forgot it back there. I was going to read something to you from it. And it says, be expectant. And I was pregnant. I'm expectant. And it said, God has things in store for you beyond your wildest dreams. Look for the good things. Well, I was always ready for the problems because I could solve them. I've been through that before. I could do this, you know. And look for the good things. And you can expect, be expectant of good things. And what a concept, you know. I was like a toilet waiting to be flushed. You know, I could always take the bad stuff. But all of a sudden, I said, okay, God, I know you don't want me to live like this anymore. I was pregnant, but that's okay. I can have this baby, and I'm not going to bring him into this insane marriage. And that was in July 13th of 1977. September, my divorce was final. I was still pregnant. October, I had the baby on my natal birthday. And January, I met my present husband. So when I let go and let God and finally said, okay, God, and I got really active in AA, I started going to meetings every day. That first from July 13th to the 23rd, I went to, the 1 week, I went to 10 meetings in 1 week, AA meetings. I dropped everything but AA because I wanted a drunk. I wanted to run away. I had a suitcase packed to go drink, and I wanted out. I wanted to just say the hell with everything. And that's the hell with it attitude gets people drunk. And so what happened was Bernie called me. Bernie was Bernadette, and she had 4 children, and she was divorced, and she had custody of those children. She had the car, she had the house, she had everything. And Bernie calls me, and she says, Alice, she says, you still go to that midnight meeting? And I said, yeah. I had a babysitter set up so I could go drinking that night. And she says, well, could you take me to that meeting? And I said, well, you're not AA, you're Al-Anon. And she says, well, 3 months ago, on a Friday night, I went out with my friends, and it's now 3 months later. I just got out of a halfway house from alcohol and drugs. And I said, oh. You know that phone call that you want to make when you're in trouble? It's not always for you. It's usually for the person you're calling. She told my story right down the line what would have happened to me. I would have lost my health, my self-respect, my children, everything. And by the grace of God, Bernie called me. You know, I don't know if Bernie's sober today, but 31 years ago, she saved my sanity and my sobriety. I got to be really active in AA. So July 13, 77, I was 11 years sober. My son was born that year on my birthday. I met my husband in January. A little bit of that. I met him, and I had 6 children. I knew I was going to be single and sober for a long time. And I accepted that because I was raising those kids myself anyways. I finally realized that after I was divorced, I was already raising them by myself. And so I met this guy, and I looked at him, and he came to our home group. And, you know, home groups, they usually have like a table everybody sits at in Cleveland. We had our home group table where everyone that worked, that was active in the group, sat at. And he walks in, he sits down. I said, oh, are you a member of this group? He said, no. I said, well, this is the home group table. Oh, well, I'll sit over there, you know. And so I asked my girlfriend, I said, can he sit over here? And she says, yeah, he can sit over here. I said, okay, she said you could sit over here. So we came back and sat. And he says to me, I said to him, I says, well, how long have you been sober? And he says, 3 years. I says, are you married? And he says, because there was guys that were married, they're being jerks and asked, you know, getting with the people that they didn't know weren't newcomers. I was 11 years sober, but they didn't know that. They knew I was new to the meeting hall. And so he says, yeah, I'm single. And I said, have you ever been married? He said, never been married. I said, oh, good. I says, I want to stay single and sober. And I said, would you like to go out for a sandwich? And this was a midnight meeting. So he says, yeah. I go, oh. Now what do I do? I never asked a guy out before. That was one of those rules I never always followed. I never asked a guy out. And so we got in his truck, and he was driving, and we get to make the left turn into Denny's. He goes, oh, I forgot. I'm not getting paid till tomorrow morning. I don't have money for sandwiches. I said, let's just have coffee. So we went and had coffee, and I pretty much told him what I told you tonight, everything that, you know, in my life and what was going on with me. And I just wanted to know how to stay single and sober. And it was my purity of thought. In Cleveland, too, they go through the absolutes, purity, honesty, unselfishness, and love. And the purity of intent is really important. When you're doing something for a good reason, it doesn't matter what other people think you're doing it for. it's, you know, it's going to happen good. And what happened was the next day he asked me for a sandwich because he got paid. And he took me out and we had a sandwich. And he thought I was going to talk again. No. He gets to talk. And he told me his story. And within 2 weeks he asked me to marry him. And within another month we got married. And and that was almost 32 years ago. We moved to California after he got married. He was looking for a family. I didn't know this. He had prayed. He asked his sponsor because he was 3 years sober, and he says, "Was this all there is in sobriety? I want to share my sobriety with somebody." And they said, "Well, pray. God might have something in store for you." Then I asked him out, so he thought that was the answer to his prayer. And shouldn't have prayed so hard. You know? he says when he talks, he says, "Watch what you pray for." But so what happened was we got married, and 4 months later, he got a letter from California. Well, my ex-husband used to get junk mail from California, and it was usually pornographic, and I just threw it out, you know. And I forget what the name of the place was, Volt Technical. That sounded pretty pornographic to me. And so I handed him the letter, because I don't open other people's mail. So he opens up the letter, he goes, "Oh, I got a job." And I'm going, "Oh, what did I marry?" And he says, "I got a job with a phone company in California. Would you go with me?" And I said, "I'll go anywhere with you." And he said, "What about the kids?" And I said, "Oh, they'll go too." He, you know, but we did. We took the 6 kids and traveled across country and moved out here. And halfway there, he goes, "What if we don't make it in California?" I said, "Well, at least we went. You know, let's do it a day at a time." That's been a constant in my life, one day at a time, you know. And we're seeing mountains I never saw. We saw the Mississippi River. We did all this, you know, in that trip. And so we get out here, and he was one day late to start for one company, and he went with the other company. And he stayed 30 years with that company. And I like to say we lived happily ever after, but the first child we decided to have, I had a miscarriage, and then we waited a year before we got pregnant again, and we had a 10-pound monster child, human child, and and I went back to the bowling alley after I had the baby, and he says, "Where's your male human child that you had?" And he's 29 years old now. And then Bill talked me into another one, and we had another little boy, and he's going to get married this week, and he's 26 years old. I love to tell you we lived happily ever after, but when you have 5 teenagers in the house and you live in Baldwin Park, where the people all just got released from their 5 years in prison from drugs and alcohol, and your kids just turned teenagers, you've got some problems. And my son told me he was not a part of a gang. He's 6'5", living in Baldwin Park, and he had a bat that said Rojo on it, but he didn't belong to a gang. I'm like, yeah, I'm stupid too. But you know, it's amazing. You get through those things one day at a time. We had a meeting, just happened to be two blocks from my house, so if my kids needed me, they could come over and get me. And we went to meetings 3 times, 4 times a week. Bill didn't like meetings, so I had to dress up real cute one day and say, not ask him to go with me anymore. I was asking him, I was like, "Come on, honey, let's go. And he'd go, no, you can go. And I look real cute one night, and he goes, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to the meeting." And he says, "Well, how come you didn't ask me to go?" I says, "You know, Bill, I'm tired of asking you to go. You don't want to go? Fine." I says, "The guys think I'm single? Okay, fine." But once they brought this handsome, giant, tall, 6'4", gorgeous man with me, they left me alone, you know? And so you got to use your womanly wiles, you know, that's still a little bit, do that. But we've been really doing a good life. We did that one son, that the one that had the Rojo on his bat, he did a lot of things, and one thing he did was he moved to Vegas, got involved with the wrong people, and went to prison for a year, and came home, and the only place he could live was with me and my husband, because we were the only ones sober. His brothers and sisters were still on the drugs and alcohol, and so he came and lived with us for 6 months, and he got married to a young girl that he got pregnant with on my couch one night, and they got married, and they were like the happiest couple in the family, and but he got into painkillers for his back, and he got into drinking very heavily, and I went up to see him. I was diagnosed with breast cancer in November of 2006, and April 2007 I had to have a double mastectomy. And you know, AA just simplifies everything. I told somebody I had, you know, Bill told everyone. Bill tells everything. And he told them Alice has got cancer, blah, blah, blah. So I get the phone calls. One girl calls me at Rena. I don't know how many of you know Rena. Rena calls me, Alice, this is Rena. I says, hi, Rena. She says, you know what? If you're going to have breast cancer, 2007 is the best time to have it because they know a hell of a lot more than they did when I got it 8 years ago. I said, thanks, Rena. And so it was like a rollback going through it. And, you know, we have friends in the program that had cancer before you. They take you to the, like Mary took me to almost all of my doctor appointments. But I had that surgery on Tuesday. I went up to see my son because I knew he was concerned about me when he found out I had the cancer. And I went up to see him and tell him not to worry and just see how he was doing. He was doing very poorly. He wouldn't go to a meeting with me. So he went to church with me and he kissed me goodbye. And that was the last time I saw him. A week and a day after my surgery, he hung himself drunk. And he was taking pain medications for his back and drinking on top of it. Thought he lost his job, and he hadn't lost his job. But the drinking and the perception he had under the influence killed him. And that was 2.5 years ago. And my kids are all coming. First time we're going to actually have an opportunity to get a picture of all seven children together is this tomorrow, Sunday. Happens to be my 43-year anniversary in AA. And but they want me to have a party for them for just to get together before the wedding. And it's really hard on me because I am not really happy about this because they're all, like, still drinking and out there except for the one that I had when I was going through my divorce. He's got almost 2 years sobriety, and he's been living with us for the last year and a half, almost 2 years. And he's like the helper guy, you know. And we have the same natal birthday, so we went out to a play and saw Singing in the Rain live performance at a dinner theater on my birthday. So good things happen, bad things happen. You know, it just, if you do it one day at a time, it doesn't all happen on the same day. It doesn't, you know, if something happens in the morning, you still got the afternoon to do something fun, you know. So, I mean, that's how I look at it. I mean, there's 24 hours. You can lose your job in the morning, but go to the beach and, you know, surf in the afternoon. What the hell? I mean, you have to take the day as it comes. That's how my one day at a time works. That's how, you know, just for today. Just for today, I'll be happy. I make up my mind to be happy. And I hope you do, too. And I think that if, you know, no matter what happens in your life, good things will happen to it, but be expectant of the good things. Don't keep thinking, oh, shit, what's going to happen next? You know, I can't do that. I would not have lived 43 years sober. And my kid says, Mom, you went through that. You know what happened? You know, and these terrible things are happening all around me. And I says, yeah, but I was sober through it. And if you're going sober through it, it's like you don't have to be responsible for it. It's none of your business. They're doing this stuff. They're going to jail. They're doing the things they have to do. And people were saying, oh, my, so sorry about your son. And I says, you know, I'm sorry about it too. But, you know, I had him for 33 years. And I loved him, and he loved me. And I knew he went right. I knew when he, just as he was going to, you know, do this, he went, I don't really want to do this. God said, I gotcha. And he took him in his arms. And I think that, you know, we're all loved no matter what we do. We have to know that God loves us. And I love you too, and thank you for letting me share.